daughter. Now, here's the backstory. Come on, come on. Lyell is the real reason that Abdu came. She's been riding horses in Montana. And she's trying to move the family. So are we going to let Dad talk tonight? I think so. Please give a warm welcome to Dad.
The first podium that's ever been too high for me. This is just the right height. It's great. Thank you so much. You know, I was thinking about it as when Dick said it earlier, he's going to, you know, talk to my daughter Lyell. He said, now I'm going to introduce you, is that okay? She said, yeah. She thought he meant from here. He's going to say, hi, Lyell, wave your hand. So the fact that you were on stage, it was embarrassing. Gives you a little lesson. There's no such thing as a free lunch. Everything comes with a price, including more riding horses in Montana. The second thing, you need to listen to Dad. And she's done it so often, and she's heard me speak so often that sometimes I wonder if she gets anything. You can get this talk if you want it. She wants you to give it to some beautiful Zaka. Probably even better. What a joy it is to be with you here in Montana. We love this state. We've come back. This is our third time, actually. The second time I came for a writing retreat. I was writing Saving Truth, actually. I was writing the chapter on, if I'm not mistaken, I was writing the chapter on pluralism and the different religious systems that are out there. Is there really any clarity we could have on which worldview is the true worldview? So I was out here, and because I give the kids, all my kids, I have three wonderful kids, I give them a pick of trips that year. So I lay out the calendar in front of them over the course of the year, and I say, you can pick a trip that's just you and me. We're just going to go you and me. So my son usually picks New York City. He loves big cities. My youngest daughter always picks Colorado. She loves the mountains. She loves just being in Colorado. And Lyell always, if she can, if I'm coming to Montana, she picks Montana. So this time I'm coming to Montana because, and this is not a joke, and Dick said that I'm along for the ride. I think he sent my assistant an email that said, an invitation for Lyell to come, and if her dad comes, he can speak somewhere. I'm sure we can make it happen. So here we are with you today. Now, what I want to share with you this evening is a bit of a heady topic, and it's going to sound a little bit doom and gloom at first. I want to assure you I'm actually an optimist. I'm actually a bit of a starry-eyed optimist when it comes down to things, but I'm also a realist. I think that's the balance in the Christian life, is that you have this future hope that comes from the resurrection of Jesus, knowing that your body will one day be sown in corruption and raised incorruptible, and that future hope. But we also live in the realism of what sin has done in the world. So Christians always balance the sense of realism, which is sometimes depressing, with the counterbalance of hope, which is always, hopefully, uplifting. So it's going to sound a little bit like that as I begin to talk about this post-truth culture that we're finding ourselves in. But as I begin, let me just share a sort of a humorous thing that happened to me a while back. Some years ago, I was traveling internationally, and as Dick said, I travel quite a bit internationally. In fact, in a couple of weeks, I'll be going to Sri Lanka, and then over to Dubai to do some speaking, and then I can't remember where else I'm flying off to after that. But it won't be in this country, it'll be other countries, and then coming back and doing a bunch of trips before I run out the year in various big cities in the United States. But I was going internationally for a speaking trip, but because I live in Detroit, Canada is considered an international speaking trip that I get to drive to. Because we border Canada on our, looks like, does Montana border Canada on the northern side? Of course it does. It's like one of the longest borders, I think, in the country that borders Canada. Well, our border is covered by water. So in order to get to Canada, you have to either go over the bridge, the Ambassador Bridge, the Blue Water Bridge, or under the river through a tunnel. But this was a unique event because it was in a place called Wallaceburg, Ontario. And Wallaceburg is not close to either of the two bridges that are by where I live, nor is it by the tunnel. But it is by this car ferry that takes you across the Detroit River or the waterway that separates Lake Huron and Lake St. Clair. So I go over to this car ferry to get on this thing and go over to Canada. And when I think of car ferries, being from the Great Lakes state, where the lakes are the sizes of oceans, I think ship. That's what I think. I think a ship That's three times the size of this room, that could hold multiple cars, 20, 30, 40 cars. That was not the boat that I got on this day. When I got to this little port, it was a customs and border control area, and it was this little white, paint peeling off of it, rickety, I think it was a boat. It was a floating platform of sorts, and the guy said, this is the car ferry. It fit two cars total. It's no bigger than this stage. This is how big this thing was. So I get out of the car ferry, and because I'm hopeless with directions, I'm just terrible with them. I can get lost in my own backyard. So I'm constantly looking down at the GPS in my car, which has made my sense of direction worse, actually. Because now I don't have to think about it anymore. This machine tells me where to go. So I'm always looking at it because I'm paranoid. I'm going to get lost. And I'm going into international waters and over onto an international border. So now I'm really terrified that I'll get lost. And who knows, maybe the Mounties will pick me up and then deport me, which is okay because I'll go home, I guess. But I don't want to go home. I want to go speak. So I get onto this car ferry. The guy says, stay in your car. It's not going to be that long of a ride. It was blazing hot that summer. I was going to speak in an open tent, evangelistic thing at this big event in Wallaceburg. I was very much obliged to stay in the car because I didn't want to swelter in the heat. So I stayed in the car. Well, I was obsessively looking at my GPS when the car left the dock. So because of that, I didn't see us leave the dock. Now, being in the car, the suspension of the car and its sheer mass absorbed all the energy of us leaving the dock. So you know how when you leave the dock, you sort of feel that rocking motion? Well, the car absorbed all that, so I didn't feel it at all. So I had that feeling, you know, when the car left the dock, I had that feeling you have when you're sitting at an intersection and the bus is next to you and the bus goes forward, you're not quite sure if it's going forward or you're moving backward. There's that vertigo that happens. What's the first thing you do? Well, the first thing you do is hit the brakes as hard as you can so you don't kill somebody. But the first thing you do is to check to see if you're actually moving. And what do? You look for something that's fixed, a fixed point of reference, whether it's a mailbox or a streetlight or a building or whatever it might be, to determine if you're moving or not. And when you find out that you're not moving, that nausea, that vertigo, and that panic all goes away. Well, I was in the river. Everything's moving in the river. So the river's not helping me. There's no fixed point of reference. Everything is flowing through. The boat won't help me because I'm on the boat. So if the boat's moving, it can't help me. So I have no fixed points of reference. It's when I looked at the distant shore and I saw that it actually was getting bigger in my field of vision. That's when I realized, yes, okay, I'm moving now. And all of a sudden, the confusion and the vertigo cleared up. But it took some time. I tell you this because I think this is what describes culture best. Culture is in the river. We don't have any fixed points of reference within our immediate purview. Now, we acknowledge that there are fixed points of reference. There is dry land, but we left it so long ago. We left that which was stable so long ago that we forgot what dry land feels like. In fact, in some ways, we've come to resent what dry land feels like. We don't like the feeling of stability. We like the confusion. Think about the questions we're being asked today. I want you to think about what our young people are having to deal with, the questions they're being asked today. What it means to be human is a basic question that we thought we had the answers to a long time ago, but now you're asking yourself, and with the transhumanism movement, I don't mean the transsexual movement, I mean transhumanism. Look it up. Transhumanism is a movement being started right now by people who are called biohackers and people who are scientists who are trying to thrust their way through with wanton abandon into the forefront of what it means to be human, changing what it means to be human. You know, we have prosthetic limbs, for example, to help people who are injured, whether it's in combat or some kind of an accident, or maybe it's a birth defect, or whatever it might be. That's well and good, but they're saying, no, we don't need prosthetics to help the injured. Why don't we put prosthetics on people who are perfectly healthy and make them stronger or taller or faster or put brain implants so you can remember things better or have your eyesight changed or edit someone's genes so that they're taller or they're not susceptible to a disease or they're smarter or they're superhumanly strong. They're trying this right now. So what it means to be human used to be something that was obvious. And it no longer is. In fact, part of the secular humanist movement is to suggest that humans, one branch of it, which is ironic, humans aren't all that special. We're just sophisticated chips or really complex meat computers, just like every other animal. So dumbing down what it means to be human is happening at the same time where we elevate what it means to be human and we engage in this schizophrenia about our own existence. And of course, that leads to further questions. Like, not only what does it mean to be human, but what does it mean to be male? What does it mean to be female? What does it mean to be married? When is marriage only between one man and one woman? Is it a different institution altogether? What does it mean to have peace? When does life begin? When can we end life? Can we force someone to end their life if they're not useful or not wanted? These are the questions all of us are asking, but the ones who have to answer it with the greatest amount of uncertainty are the ones who have to live with the consequences, and it's the young, it's my daughter, it's her friends, it's people her age. And so you see a growing anxiety beginning to happen. You see it happening in society where the statistics will show you that people who are between the ages of 10 and I think it's 18, or maybe it's 13 and 35, I can't remember the exact ages, but it's a wide range, but the young are the highest percentage of those who have the highest anxiety in a generation. The highest levels of anxiety in a generation. They've never had it so good. There's technology at their fingertips, everything they could possibly want, information like that. Yet they have the highest levels of anxiety. Why is that? Because we're asking them to decide these questions at 8 years old. Now, I see in this crowd there are some young folks, but a lot of you folks not only are children of the 80s, but you have children who are children of the 80s. Like me. I'm a child of the 80s. I'm 3016 this year. That's my age. Figure that one out. I'm not going to say 46. I just didn't cheat. All right. In your 40s, you kind of just figure out who you are. You just figure that out. Some of us in this room have just figured out who we actually are. We've got ourselves sort of wrapped around our mind is around who we actually are. And yet we're asking eight-year-olds, you can define what you are and who you are. And by the way, when we define that at 8 years old, we're going to chemically enforce it and make it permanent. Can you imagine the kind of anxiety you would have if someone told you, you can decide at 10, 12, 11, whatever it might be, who you are, and we're going to permanently fix it that way, and it can never change. No wonder they're going anxiety. This is a world rife with confusion. Confusion that we can't seem to unseat ourselves from, but we seem to be embracing as much as possible. You see, we're engaged in a culture now, I think, where confusion is considered a virtue, and clarity is considered a sin. I want you to think about this for a moment, okay? Why is confusion considered a virtue? Because if there's confusion about all these issues, whether it's a social issue, or a sexual issue, or an issue about truth, when you have confusion, all the boundary lines get fuzzy. So you don't have to stay within a box. You don't have to, there aren't limits to anything. There aren't even limits to our freedoms. We can do whatever we want in whatever way we want, when, however we want, to anyone we want. And confusion allows that, it fosters it, because it blurs the boundaries. But clarity provides boundaries. It says, look, this is true, this is false, stay within what's true, or within what's good, whatever it might be. And so we don't like clarity anymore because clarity brings restriction. So confusion becomes a virtue, clarity becomes a sin. I want you to think about this carefully. If you look into the news, and you look into the news of the day, ask yourself this question. If you're confused sexually, you're a hero. If you're confused morally, you're progressive. If you're confused on religion, you know, all religions lead to God. There can't be one particular one. What does it all mean anyway? Maybe they're all equally invalid. All this stuff. You don't know the answers, you're considered tolerant. So sexual confusion is heroic. Moral confusion is progressive. Religious confusion is tolerant. But if you're clear on sexual boundaries, well, then you're bigot. If you're clear on moral boundaries, you're regressive. And if you're clear that maybe there is just enough good evidence to believe that there is one way to God, and that way is actually provable, that's considered intolerant. Confusion becomes the virtue. Clarity becomes the sin. But we are clear on one thing, and here's the important part. For all of us to take to heart, it's not always just them who sort of harbors this desire for confusion. We have to understand this. In this post-truth world, here's what we're very clear about, no matter what our worldview is. They are always wrong. Whoever they is, they're always wrong. If you don't agree with me, then you become Hitler. I mean, think about this. What are you seeing in society today? When you see something on Fox, or see it on CNN, or see it on MSNBC, or whatever, pick a news station, just pick it. All they ever do now is, instead of giving you actual news, is begin to say, those people are horrible. So if you're on the right, the left is always telling lies. If you're on the left, the right is always telling lies. If you're in the center, the right and the left are constantly telling lies. We've Hitlerized everybody. See, what happens in this culture right now, where we've embraced confusion as a virtue, is that we don't want anybody to disagree with us. How dare you disagree with me? So what ends up happening is this, is that if you don't agree with me, you're Hitler, or Stalin, or pick your despot. Now notice what I said. I didn't say, if you disagree with me, you're Hitler. I said, if you don't agree with me, you're Hitler. You can't even be neutral. You can't have a considered opinion. You have to agree with me more than I agree with me, or else I'm going to label you and shame you into silence. That's what's happening today. So the anxiety levels are high. The anger levels are high. And we begin to wonder, where is it all going? Because it doesn't sound like it's going in a great direction. As I said before, I'm a child of the 80s. And I remember a song that was written in the 80s called Land of Confusion by the band Genesis. This was happening during the Cold War. During the height of the Cold War in the 1980s, when children were waking up in the middle of the night, they were like having nightmares. I was one of them. You'd have nightmares because the Cold War between the USA and the USSR had suddenly become nuclear hot because someone decided to push a button and prove who's the toughest. So kids were riddled with anxiety in the 80s. It was called a Cold War neurosis. And amidst this, this song was written called Land of Confusion by the band Genesis. And listen to the words when they say it. Oh, Superman, where are you now when everything's gone wrong somehow? These men of steel, these men of power are losing control by the hour. Oh, Superman, where are you now when everything's gone wrong somehow? These men of steel, these men of power are losing control by the hour. That was written 30 years ago. That can be written today. Amidst all the confusion. As if to prove my point, in 2016, Oxford English Dictionaries christened this word of the year to be the word post-truth. Now every year, Oxford Dictionaries names a word of the year. Now the word of the year, to qualify as the word of the year, that particular word doesn't have to be new. This has to be a word that is coming into fashion and it captures the ethos and the pathos and the fascinations of the culture for that particular year. And in 2016, especially at the end of the election cycle, the word of the year was post-truth. Now, what does post-truth mean? Someone or something is post-truth when it elevates feelings and preferences above facts and truths. It's very important you understand the subtlety here. Post-truth exists, this culture is post-truth, because it elevates feelings and preferences above facts and truths. Now, that might sound like postmodernism, the idea that there is no such thing as objective truth, it's all just personal preferences and feelings, but it's not the same. It's a very subtle but important distinction. So let me map this out for you. Postmodernism said there is no such thing as truth. There is no such thing as objective truth. Now, when someone says there's no such thing as objective truth, what's the obvious response to that? Is that statement objectively true? Because if they say there's no such thing as objectively true, the statement has to be objectively true, and if it is, then it's false. But if it is true that there are no objective truths, well then that truth has to be true. It means that the statement itself is again false, which makes the whole thing self-defeating. It's all nonsense. The minute I say that my truth is relative to me, and then someone else says, yeah, but it's not to me, and I think your truth isn't true, now we have this competing battle speak. That's why postmodernism is dying. So postmodernism said, there is no such thing as truth. But from the ashes of postmodernism's death arises this phoenix of post-truth. And it looks so similar, but it's not the same. Postmodernism said, there is no such thing as truth. Post-truth says, we acknowledge that truth exists, but we put it on the bottom shelf because our preferences matter more. In other words, when you look at someone who's postmodern, they say there's no such thing as truth, you can reason them out of that position. But someone who's post-truth says, truth exists, but I don't care. How do you reason with that? They look at you and they say, yeah, you've given me all these facts. It might be true, but my preferences matter more, and your facts happen to conflict with my preferences, and so I'm going to ignore them or lie about them. Because my truth, and this phrase you see all the time, tell them your truth, tell them your truth. It's not your truth, it's just truth. But people don't want it because they want their preferences more. They want their preferences more. We have sacrificed, and why is that, by the way? How do we get here? How do we get to the point where truth is no longer as important as our preferences and our feelings? One might think this is a modern development, that this has happened recently. And yes, I've just laid out for you, postmodernism was something that dies and post-truth rises up from its ashes. But the reality was, post-truth was smoldering under the surface the entire time human beings existed. For the entire time. I want you to look at the Adam and Eve story. If you go back to the very first encounters of human beings with each other and with God, you'll see post-truth all throughout. Remember when I said post-truth is? Post-truth is when you elevate feelings and preferences above facts and truth. So you acknowledge that truth exists, but you make them subordinate to your preferences. What is the Adam and Eve story all about? You see them, they are created specially by God to be in communion with him. Genesis chapter 3 says that he walks and talks with them in the cool of the day. You can't get more chummy than that. And he says, there's one thing you can't have. The rest of the garden, all of it's yours. Only one thing you can't eat of is the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. For in the day you eat it, you shall surely die. Now, who knows how long they lived with that? And were never tempted by it. They never were tempted by the fruit, ever. But along comes Satan. He says, did God really say? And he misquotes God. And then Eve, and by proxy Adam, misquote God back. They add more restrictions than he actually added. So that right there, Satan knows, I've got them. They don't have the word of God hidden in their heart because they misquoted him. And now I can misquote him all I want because they won't know what hit them next. And then he says to her, God knows you won't die the day you eat of it, but you will become like God, knowing good and evil. And that part's true. But the consequences, he hid from them. And then suddenly, this fruit that never tempted her before, never tempted him before, suddenly this fruit becomes desirable. Why? Because Satan played to their preferences. You see, the truth they were told over and over again, the truth they lived with, was that they were made to be in communion with God, but their preference was to be God. And so they elevated their preferences above facts and truth. The first post-truth people were the first people. It is not a right problem or a left problem. It's a human heart problem. We are autonomy-seeking creatures. See, Adam and Eve wanted autonomy. Now, it's important for us to understand this. We speak about the word freedom all the time. We pledge allegiance to a flag based on the idea of a republic that's based on the idea of freedom. Now, freedom, you know, sort of litters everything about human existence in the West, especially in America. Our songs are about freedom. Our movies are about freedom, whether it's, you know, Braveheart or Amistad or The Patriot or whatever movies you would have about winning freedom and all this wonderful stuff. And it's all great. But Oz Guinness once said, I believe it was Oz who said, that you can always judge the health of a culture by the way it interacts with its chief virtue. And the chief virtue of the West is freedom. But here's the problem. We have been so indulgent in freedom that we stopped talking about freedom a long time ago. We keep using the word, but we don't really mean freedom. See, freedom has boundaries, and I'll get to that momentarily. What we're now speaking about, instead of freedom, is autonomy. And autonomy is not the same thing. You know, we think of autonomy as being synonymous with freedom, but it really isn't. Autonomy comes from two Greek root words, the word autos, which means self, and the word nomos, which means law. So when you are autonomous, when you are autos nomos, when you are autonomous, you are a law unto yourself. That means you can be, say, act, think, whatever you want, in whatever way you want, at any time you want, no matter what anybody else says, not even the truth. That's not the same thing as freedom. That is unbridled ability. And that leads to very serious chaoses. I want you to think about it for a moment, okay? Think about it just for a moment. If I'm a law unto myself, I'm autonomous. I'm a total law unto myself. And someone else, maybe you, you're a law unto yourself. Okay? You have equal authority as I do to be autonomous, to define our own existences. And our preferences matter more than truth in a post-truth world. What happens when me, as an autonomous creature, clashes with you, an also autonomous creature, because my preferences and your preferences conflict? What happens when truth's on the bottom shelf of all of our existence? The thing that used to guide our principles when two people clashed over their preferences or their opinions, the thing that used to decide who was right and who was wrong, if anybody was right or wrong, was truth. But now the truth no longer matters. The problem is this. Truth won't determine who's right and who's wrong. You know what will? Power. The loudest microphones or the most guns. That determines who's right and who's wrong. Now, can you see the irony in all of it? The irony here? I want you to take a moment and think about it. Autonomy. We strive for autonomy. Unchained ability. We can do whatever we want. But when two autonomies come together, someone gets enslaved. How's that for irony? That in your search for unlimited freedom, you end up enslaving someone? And we see it all the time now. People are victims to it all the time. Their religious convictions don't matter as much as someone else's preferences. So the very first freedoms upon which this country was built are subjugated to the preferences of their genuine witness. Because preferences matter more than truth. See, what we've done, ladies and gentlemen, is we planted the seeds of a post-truth culture in the very first garden, way, way back. And now that tree has blossomed into the post-truth tree that has its own fruit today. So it's not new, but it is ripe. We have sacrificed clarity and truth on the altar of human autonomy. Now the question is before you, and it sounds dismal, doesn't it? What do you do? If truth and facts don't matter, then why are we talking about truth and facts if they're irrelevant? Well, we can make them relevant once again. I think there's two things we can do. Two major things, and then I'll unpack them in the time we have, and then we'll go on to some questions and answer sessions, I think the second session. I really want to hear from you and maybe interact with the material with you. The two things we can do to respond to a post-truth culture. The first one's very unpleasant, but it's necessary. The first thing to do is to point out the consequences of sacrificing clarity and truth on the altar of human autonomy. The first thing is to point out the consequences. The second thing is to offer the hope that comes from embracing truth once again. And that becomes the fun part. You have to do the hard work of pointing out the consequences first. Why point out the consequences? Why? Because this is an increasingly pragmatic culture. We're very good into what works. What works? If it works, I want it. If it works, I'll buy it. We're no longer sort of morally driven. We're usefully driven. So if you can show that the post-truth mindset doesn't work, it's not useful, maybe they'll abandon it. And then they can look at it and say, ah, is there another way? And the answer is yes, there is a hope. Let me tell you something, friends, is that Ravi and I, and our whole team, there are 90-something speakers on the RZIM team globally now. But we go to these universities, no matter what country we're in, and we see it happening. We see the kids who have imbibed in the post-truth bender, and now are living in the post-truth hangover, and they don't want any of it. They're tired of it at their universities, or in their lives, whatever it might be, and they come to the microphones. At the University of Michigan, we sold out the Hill Auditorium, 3,500 seats, even though Michigan State were playing basketball down the street. At the next day at Michigan State University, 9,500 kids filled the Breslin Center so we could talk about the death of truth in the post-truth world. And they lined up the microphones to ask their questions, skeptic after skeptic after skeptic, and they weren't asking us zingers. They were asking us questions because they wanted to know, is there really an answer? And we've led some of those kids to the Lord since then. I have tremendous hope. Just got to get through the fog first, because the sun does shine through fog. So what are the consequences? What are the consequences? The first consequence that happens when we sacrifice truth on the altar of human autonomy is we lose all sense of wisdom and reason. We're embracing a culture of confusion, by the way, so it naturally follows that we would not be able to embrace wisdom anymore. If we're embracing confusion, we can't embrace wisdom. I'll give you an illustration of what I mean. A few years ago, well, it's funny because the more you do this, a few years ago, it's like 10. A decade ago, I was giving my testimony. As was Dick said in the introduction, I was a Muslim before, I was a pretty devout Muslim, and I became a Christian. And now, when I give my testimony, it was to a large group of men at men's breakfast. When I give my testimony, I typically do it by highlighting the truth of the gospel. You see, I didn't leave Islam because it was false. I embraced the gospel because it was true. Now, by implication, everything else is false. But I don't highlight that. I point out why I became a Christian, not why I left Islam. Well, as I was giving my testimony, there was a guy in the front row who was taking furious notes. He wasn't angry. I don't mean furious and angry. I mean like the pen was racing across the page, like smoke from the page kind of thing, like where's the fire signature? That guy was in flames. What was happening there? And typically what happens is that the guy who's taking the most notes is almost always the first person to talk to you when you're not. Which is a great part of what I do for a living. I talk to people after I speak, and we engage in wonderful conversations. Well, sure enough, here he came. I got done with my talk, and here he comes. And he says, you know, I really appreciated the way you talked about your conversion and that you didn't disagree with Islam. I'm like, well, you didn't get the point, I don't think, because I did disagree with it. If I didn't disagree with it, I would have stayed a Muslim because I would have wanted to save myself and a lot of people I love a whole lot of pain in changing my worldview. So I naturally did disagree with it, but I can see why you say that because I speak about the gospel, not against Islam and all that, but keep going, go ahead. He says, well, I have something I want to show you. Now, if someone says that and you're a public speaker, I want to show you something. It's going to be a long conversation. So he had a diagram he had drawn. And in the diagram, he had this big capital T scribbled in, bold, right in the middle of it, the circle around it. He said, this represents the total objective truth, and there is such a thing. I said, good, so far we agree. He says, but we don't know all of it. None of us knows all of it. I said, well, so far we agree there as well, because if I knew all the truth, then I would know everything. Only one being knows everything, that's God. So far we agree that I'm not God. Great start. He said, but there are relative truths or incomplete truths. And he had all these little lowercase t's that were surrounding the capital T. And they all had arrows going towards it. It's a very Buddhist idea, by the way. They claim to be a Christian. He says, all of us, every one of us, every human being on earth, has a lowercase t, incomplete version of the truth. I said, really? He said, yeah, all of us. Like, all of us? Like Hitler, Idi Amin, Mao Zedong, Pol Pot, Joseph Stalin, Mussolini, I keep going. These men all have incomplete versions of the truth. I'm telling you, this is what he said to me. He said, I can tell you this, I don't prefer their version of the truth because my version is also incomplete. I can't disagree with them either. This is a very well-read, very well-meaning, I would assume moral man who's telling me he can't disagree with Hitler. Like, buddy, if there's one guy you can disagree with and no one has mad at you before, and those guys who do get mad at you before, I'm kind of okay with that. So I said to him, I want to be clear on this. Are you telling me you can't disagree with anybody? He says, that's right. I said, sure you can. He said, no, I can't. I said, you just did it. I was a trial lawyer for 16 years, that helps. But I wasn't trying to embarrass him. I really wasn't trying to embarrass him. What I was trying to point out is that this extremely well-read, very intelligent man has sacrificed his God-given wisdom on the altar of his preferences. You see, what he said was, I prefer that everyone gets along. There are no different worldviews. Everyone's worldviews are equally, they may be different, but they're all equally valid because they're all equally incomplete. And I don't want to go through the hard work of finding out who's right and who's wrong because someone might get offended, and I don't want that. I understand the sentiment, but the problem with that is it's right-hearted and wrong-headed. It doesn't actually get you to truth. See, the problem is this, friends. When we sacrifice our wisdom in this way specifically, we think we're respecting other people's beliefs. We're not respecting them. We're disrespecting them because we're not taking them seriously. So do not give me what I call the dignity of difference. The dignity of difference is this, is that if someone has a worldview that's different than your worldview, like let's say it's Islam, okay? I would never tell a Muslim she believes the same things as me because as a Muslim, I can tell you, when I was a Muslim, I rejected Christianity because I thought it insulted God for Christians to believe that God is a Trinity, that he would incarnate himself in a person, and that he would die on a cross. Those are the central claims of Christianity. And I thought that they're not only false, but they were blasphemous. So how dare I tell a Muslim, you know that 1,400-year history you have in your religion? Yeah, that's kind of insignificant. You all believe the same thing. Just ignore all that. Can you see how disrespectful that actually is? See, I respect Muslims, Hindus, Buddhists, atheists far too much to agree with them. I want to wrestle with the ideas. Give them the dignity of difference. You don't have to be disagreeable when you do it. You can be cordial about it. You can talk about things in an upstanding way and say, I want to get to the truth. And you can use questions and artfully chosen words to build a relationship. But you don't have to be disagreeable about it. You also don't have to compromise your worldview either. And you've heard this phrase, right? All paths lead to God. You heard this phrase? You know what the problem with that phrase is? Not all paths even claim to lead to God. Buddhism doesn't teach you to God. Buddhism, as Buddha taught it, Buddha taught not that you go to be with God in some kind of a heaven where you become enlightened. He said enlightenment means to recognize that you're actually nothing. And when you finally realize that, you won't be reborn again. You become extinguished like a flame on a candle. That doesn't sound the same thing at all like Islam, Judaism, Christianity, or any other monotheistic faiths. So to say that sounds like it's respectful, but it's actually disrespectful. But this doesn't have just implications between one guy and another guy talking after an event. It has societal implications as well when we lose our wisdom on the altar of our preferences and our autonomy. You might recall this story that happened a couple of years ago. I think it was in 2015, so okay, four. So twice a couple. There was a story that happened, you can see it on YouTube, I think, still, is that there was this protest that happened at the University of Missouri. Now, the protest was organized by the football team. They were organizing themselves to protest some racial injustices that were happening on campus. And because it's a protest, you invite the press. Because if you don't invite the press, it's a bunch of guys sitting in a room complaining, right? A protest requires national attention. And it got national attention because a Division I football program had its players organize a protest. But recall this little phenomenon they had for a while called safe spaces, where you could cry and moan and whatever you wanted to do in one spot on the campus without having anybody take pictures of you on a public university. So they had this so-called safe space at the University of Missouri in the middle of a public protest. So understand this. They have this space where you couldn't look at them, take photos, or ask them any questions at a public protest at a public university. So ESPN naturally sends a photojournalist to cover this because it's a real story, it's a good story, you want to cover it. But he wasn't asking any questions, just snapping photographs. And a woman jumps in front of the journalist's camera and starts to try to obstruct his view and his ability to take photos. So she's trying to restrict his freedom of the press, and then she gets so incensed that she says something like, "I need some muscle over here. I need some muscle over here to get rid of this aggressor. Who's going to help me remove this guy or get rid of this guy?" Physically remove a journalist from a public university. Do you know what that woman taught at the university? Journalism as part of the communications department. That is scary. I would assume an otherwise very qualified, very bright person sacrificed all sense of wisdom and the very principles upon which her profession is based because of her preferences and her feelings. When you sacrifice wisdom and clarity on the altar of autonomy, you get chaos. That's one. Number two thing we lose is integrity. When we sacrifice clarity on the altar of autonomy, we lose our integrity. Now, this is for the church as well. Okay, so I'm going to give you an example of something. All of us have to take this to heart. If you're not a non-Christian in the room, I hope you appreciate that I'm willing to point the finger backwards. If you're a Christian in the room, I hope you're willing to appreciate that I point the finger backwards. We are part of this culture. We are part of this culture. We shape it or we're shaped by it. So, in 2015, the Supreme Court legalized same-sex marriage in the Obergefell decision. Do you recall this? It was in June and July. Well, just after that, Twitter and my Facebook and all this thing were abuzz with all these stories being, emails too were being you know, sort of bombarded with stories being circulated that gay activists were suing Christian publishers in federal court, trying to get the Bible banned as hate speech, and they were using the Obergefell decision as legal precedent. Now that the law of the land allowed for same-sex marriage, they were arguing, you can ban the Bible as hate speech because it goes against this idea, so it goes against the law of the land, and therefore America. Okay, that was the argument. So I thought about this, and I said, these stories, they sound fishy. That can't be true. So I did some research. You know how long it took me to find out it wasn't true? 3 minutes. 3 minutes, a commercials break worth of research revealed to me that this story wasn't true. That yes, a gay man had sued two Christian publishers in federal court over the Bible, but he wasn't suing to have it banned as hate speech. What he was suing for was he wanted the judge to force these two publishers to retranslate the Bible to be gay affirming, and he wanted money damages because he was emotionally hurt. That was the case. Not banning the Bible is hate speech. And by the way, do you know when that lawsuit was filed? It wasn't filed after Obergefell. It was filed 7 years before Obergefell, and it was dismissed within 30 days as frivolous. I know the judge who did it. You know who propagated that story? It's true. People claiming to be Christians. That's sad. See, I understand the reason. I understand the urgency. Because when we see on social media lies being spread so quickly, you know, we have this phrase, the speed of light. When we discuss things that are fast, the new phrase ought to be the speed of lies, because nothing travels faster than lies. But we're so nervous about that, that we want to get a counter-narrative, a counter-story out there as fast as possible, and we click share, or like, or whatever it is. No matter what we, you know, the facts actually are, we read a headline, it makes they, or whoever they are, look bad. So we share it because it makes them look stupid or evil or whatever it is. Little do we know, the story is a fake. If you are a person of the truth, if you follow the one who claims to be the way, the truth, and the life, we owe this world. I stress that. We owe our Savior better than to propagate anything that could be a lie. I don't indict just any one person. I indict myself in this. Every single person is guilty of such a thing. But we see this in the secular societies as well, where we no longer have integrity as a virtue. It's happening in the sciences. It's happening there. I don't dare knock science. I don't dare disparage scientists. In fact, I was on a radio show here in Montana where I pointed out this fact that only 40% of the findings in academically peer-reviewed scientific journals can be verified. Less than half. And a guy calls on the radio and says, took a cheap shot at scientists there, you're broad brushing them all, because you're a lawyer, that's what they do. Which is funny, because it seems to me, it's like, do you see the irony there? He says, you shouldn't broad brush people, so I'm gonna broad brush you as a broad brusher. But the whole point was this, I understand the hurt there, I get it, because I'm attacking people he cares about and loves. I totally get that, believe me, I get it. But facts are facts. But it's not that all scientists are these dishonest people. That's not what I'm saying at all. Not even slight, not even a little bit. What I am saying is that you don't become immune from the pressures of a post-truth world simply because you put a white lab coat on. Because it inoculates you. Everyone loses their integrity in a culture that sacrifices clarity on the altar of our preferences. So number two is integrity. But number three, and these two go hand in hand, so I'll say one in one sense, and then I'll go on because we have to finish. Number three thing that we lose is a sense of accountability, and therefore we lose a sense of human value. We lose all accountability and a sense of human value. You know, it was Protagoras who said years ago, he said, man is the measure of all things. This philosopher said it centuries and centuries ago, man is the measure of all things. If there's no gods above us, as we are the only things that exist, the highest form of creation, then we can determine what's right, what's wrong, what's good, and what's evil. We're the ones who do that. We are the measure of all things. We've been saying that since then as well. Tom Flynn says it, a very articulate secular humanist writer. Listen to what Tom Flynn says. He says, secular humanism maintains that through a process of value inquiry informed by a scientific and reflective thought, men and women can reach rough agreement concerning values, crafting ethical systems that deliver optimal results for human beings in a broad spectrum of circumstances. That's a mouthful of a way of saying man is the measure of all things. Did you see what he said? Very important gift, that's what he says. He says, through scientific and reflective thought, men and women can reach rough agreement concerning values. I'm still waiting for that to happen. Rough agreement concerning values? Really? Are you serious? I mean, when you look at the colleges now, when you go to a university, these protests, they haven't happened in quite some time, but they were happening quite a bit, where there's things being thrown through windows and cars being lit on fire, just because somebody who offends somebody happens to be on the stage or sharing the stage at some part of the 65,000 person university, this one building is being occupied by a conservative or whatever it might be, and it's lit on fire. Where is this rough agreement concerning values? You know what's happened? We haven't come to a rough agreement concerning values, we've simply agreed on the value of being rough. That's what's happening. See what goes on here is that when you lose that sense, you lose a sense of human value as well. You really do lose a sense of human value. Because if we don't, we're not accountable to anyone above us. If there is no moral law, no objective moral law to which we're subject, then we do become the measure of all things. Here's the problem, though. Human beings are notoriously horrible at this. We're bad at this. It wasn't too long ago, lest we forget, that it was legal in this country to own people. Women just got the right to vote not too long ago, in case you were wondering. It's not like morality is this thing that we're great at. And yet we think that we're the measure of all things, if we are. Heaven help us. In fact, let me read this quote to you from Yuval Harari, a secular atheist Jew in his book Sapiens. He describes the situation. This is not a Christian. This is what he says. 70,000 years ago, Homo sapiens was still an insignificant animal minding its own business in a corner of Africa. In the following millennium, it transformed itself into the master of the entire planet and the terror of the ecosystem. Today, it stands on the verge of becoming a god, poised to acquire not only eternal youth, but also the divine abilities of creation and destruction. We are more powerful than ever before, but have very little idea of what to do with all that power. Worse still, humans seem to be more irresponsible than ever before. Self-made gods with only the laws of physics to keep us company, we are accountable to no one. We are consequently wreaking havoc on our fellow animals and on the surrounding ecosystems, seeking a little more than our own comfort and amusement, yet never finding satisfaction. Listen to him now. He says this: is there anything more dangerous than dissatisfied and irresponsible gods who don't know what they want? That's what we are. And think about this. Think about how genius we are. And this little machine that for some reason we still call phones. No one makes calls on these things. Maybe they do it around here, but they don't run anywhere else. I'll tell you that right now. You know that this little machine in my pocket has more computing power than the entire mission control that sent the first rockets to the moon? In my pocket, I can see anything I want to see at any time I want to see it on this little machine. And we think through our ingenuity, we'll come to rough agreement concerning values and all these things, and we'll somehow become autonomous and free because of these little machines. Really? Do you feel free? Do you ever have the phenomenon happen where your phone battery dies and there's no charger around? You get a little twitchy? How free do you feel when you're searching around like someone who's addicted to a drug, looking for your fix, looking for the charger? Free? Here's the worst of it. We call these things by names now. We have Alexa and Siri and whatever, you know, all that. So we humanize these machines. And you know what we use them for? Cyberbullying and pornography. We have humanized objects that we use to objectify humans because we're not accountable to anyone. Reminds me of that poem by Alexander Pope. So beautifully written decades ago that it captures what's happening today. I'm going to stop with this, and then in the second session, move on to hope. The hope part of it, then we'll take your questions. It should be a short session of talking, followed by some questions. This is what Alexander Pope says about what is in the heart of humanity. What is in the heart of humanity? He wrote this decades before post-truth became a fad. He said this: go wiser thou, and in thy scale of sense, weigh thy opinion against providence. All imperfection that thou fancy as such, say here he gives too little and there too much. Destroy all creatures that I sport or goth yet cry, if man's unhappy, then God's unjust. If man alone grows not heaven's highest care, alone made perfect here and mortal there, snatch from his hand the balance and the rod, reclaim his justice, be the God of God. In pride and reasoning pride our error lies, all quit their spheres and rush to the skies. Men are still aiming at the blessed abodes, pride is still aiming at the blessed abodes. Men would be angels, but angels would be gods, aspiring to be gods if angels fell, aspiring to be angels, men rebel. And who but seeks to invert the laws of nature sins against the eternal laws? When you snatch from his hand the balance and the rod, and you rejudge his justice and become the God of God, then you begin to invert the laws of nature, and you sin against the eternal cause, and you begin to sin against human beings as well. It is with a straight face, that someone like Peter Singer, a philosopher out of Princeton University, can argue that babies, newborn, not preborn, newborn babies have no value unless their parents value them. And if their parents don't value them, their parents can kill them. It's picked up by other philosophers as well. Alberto Giugalini and Francesca Minerva said the same exact thing in the Journal of Medical Ethics. out of Australia. They said that the baby does not have value unless the parents value it, because the baby's cognitive abilities aren't developed enough to value itself. That is a dangerous and awful place to be. And now, because we are the measure of all things, our preferences matter more. We're not only valuing and devaluing the preborn, we're now devaluing the newly born. We're saying, who needs to live, who needs to die? The consequences of a post-truth world are dire. They really are. Lack of wisdom, lack of integrity, lack of accountability, and all human value. And I want to share with you folks in the next session after the break, is how do you offer hope? Because kids are seeing that problem. Professors are seeing that problem. What's going on now? And they're beginning to think, maybe this wasn't a good idea after all. Maybe we should stop the slide into post-truth. How do we stop it? And they come to the open forum wanting an answer. In session two, I'll provide the answer. How we're seeing changes in young people's hearts, and even professors and professional people's hearts, with the hope that comes from the gospel alone. Join me in the second session. Thank you, guys. God bless you.